You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the prospect of president for life, Xi Jinping. My guests Daniela Pellad and Michael Binion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the closure of Christianity's holiest shrine in an extremely earthly row over tax and...
So Labour would seek to negotiate a new, comprehensive UK-EU customs union to ensure there are no tariffs with Europe and to help avoid any need whatsoever for a hard border in Northern Ireland.
British people now have an idea what the opposition want Brexit to look like, which is a start. Plus...
Bunch of people came out, beautiful night like this, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to be myself. And in the process, I ended up dropping about three F-bombs right from the start. So on behalf of these kids, and more importantly, their parents who brought them out to take part in their democracy, we're going to keep this PG.
When is it acceptable for politicians to talk to us the way we talk about them? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellad, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist with The Times. Welcome both. We will start in China and the possibility that President Xi Jinping is in no hurry to start work on his memoirs. He is currently due to exit office in 2023, by when he will have served the maximum of 2 5-year terms. However, the Chinese Communist Party, possibly with a measure of encouragement from someone not unadjacent to the president, has suggested lifting this limit. It does not appear a universally popular move. The armies of invigilators who monitor Chinese social media have started banning phrases like "I don't agree," "constitution," "emperor," and "Winnie the Pooh," apparently a nickname for the president. Michael, first of all, it's a bit daft, isn't it, to worry about China taking an undemocratic turn? I mean, it's China.
Yes, and of course, for the past 50 years, they've had a whole lot of measures, government systems, and things that have been far from democratic. And one only has to look back at the revered Mao Zedong's era, where the man went completely mad. Millions died, millions were persecuted, far from democracy at all. But in recent years, China has become more open, more democratic, and it's only in the last 2 or 3 years where we have seen quite a crackdown on freedom of expression and on any kind of political activity that isn't closely aligned to the Communist Party, where we realise that the present president is in fact pretty controlling and has dictatorial ambitions.
Daniela, what do you think? Is it arguable if this is seen from the outside world, which may have an opinion on this for all the difference it's likely to make to the Chinese Communist Party, but might there be a lot of Western governments thinking, well, you know what you're getting into, you could do worse, doesn't really make a difference either way, whatever?
Well, I think absolutely. We haven't seen a lot of noise over support for pro-democracy voices in China, really. In a way, this is quite refreshing that we see this so obvious and there's no even pretense at consensus like there have been with Erdogan and Putin, for instance. No one's pretending anything. They're not saying, right, we'll consult and we'll have a referendum or anything. It's just...
Or do that thing that Putin did where he pretended not to be president for a few years.
Exactly. This is much more straightforward. We all know what it is. I can't see anybody. I can't even see any sort of limply worded protest, really, from the outside world.
I mean, it's a general principle, though, Michael, the 2 5-year limit or the 2 4-year limit, it's not universal practice by any mean, the idea of term limits. Do you think in general they are a good idea? There is, of course, an argument that in a democracy it's the voters' decision to make about whether somebody bangs on and on and on for years. But the US famously limits presidents to 2 4-year terms, although you could be forgiven for wondering just at the moment how bright an idea that is. Is it a good idea? Should people be given
a specific
limit?
Yeah, in the US it came in after Roosevelt was elected for 4 terms.
Indeed.
He didn't last all the way through. He died very shortly into his 4th term. But everybody thought that he was one of the greatest presidents ever, and it wasn't because they thought he was becoming dictatorial or manipulating the system. It was simply because they thought that this set a precedent of if somebody stays in power forever and ever, then in the end the opposition probably have no chance whatsoever. And I think in China they went to a term limit constitution because they were, frankly, worried that another sort of Mao would come along who would build it up into a cult of personality and start embarking on the most crazed kind of ideas that would be really disastrous for China. No, many countries don't have term limits. In Britain, there is no term limit on how many times somebody can be prime minister. You can somebody could stay in office for as long as the voters go on voting for them. And in most democracies, I don't see that a term limit is necessarily a guarantee of good democracy. It's probably desirable in some very large countries where there is the possibility that somebody could abuse the power they're in. Having said all that, I have to say that most Chinese, a lot of them, feel that much of the work that President Xi is claiming credit for isn't finished, particularly the war on corruption. And there is a worry that if he goes in a few years, all that will unravel.
The record, I think, in my own home country of Australia, I'm right in saying, is 18 years. That was Sir Robert Menzies in his second stint as Prime Minister, in fact, having had a brief whack at it before the Second World War. The thing I was trying to think of was, Daniela, is there any government that's ever actually improved, or any leadership that has improved in decade two? I mean, people just get tired, don't they?
Interesting. I don't think so. And I think too much, even good leaders, proficient leaders, get somewhat crazed by as soon as they slip into double figures. It never has a positive effect. And we're going to talk about Israel later on as well. Well, the Prime Minister there, Netanyahu, has been in office more or less longer than any other leader in his country's history. And despite his current problems, doesn't seem like there's much of an opposition even ready to replace him. So I'm not sure that it does have a beneficial effect on the country's opposition either.
Well, given that you have set that seamlessly up for us, let's look now at Israel and Jerusalem specifically, and even more specifically, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre contained therein. Popularly regarded as the site of the crucifixion, burial and resurrection of Jesus Christ, its administration has been bedeviled for years by rivalries among the various Christian denominations which oversee it. This reporter, i.e. me, was in fact once treated to quite a lively punch-up between rival clerics on a visit circa 2000, if memory serves. They swatted each other with brochures before being led away by police officers. The church is now to be closed altogether in protest against new taxes proposed by Israel. A, quote, systematic and unprecedented attack against Christians in the Holy Land, said church leaders in a statement of questionable historical rigour. Daniela, briefly, what is the actual problem here? What are they upset about?
Well, there are two things. First of all, Jerusalem's mayor wants them to start paying their municipal tax, which Christian churches were allowed not to. And there's another discussion in the Israeli parliament about being able to take over properties which the church sold to private owners, which would have has an effect on Jerusalem property prices, and it gets very complicated. But the real issue here is that the Christian community and the church leaders feel, with some justification, that the Israeli government has acted in a very tone-deaf and bullying manner without consultation. And this is very dramatic action they've taken, but they don't feel that there's any other real way for them to make their voices heard.
Just to follow that up, though, how are the church leaders seeing this? Do they think, are they just complaining because they're about to be taxed like anybody else would be, or are they right in perceiving a more sinister agenda?
Well, you know, a lot of this does, of course, have to do with internal politics as well, and municipal politics too. But Christianity is a big, in terms of tourism, to put it bluntly, is a big draw when it comes to Jerusalem and the rest of and the rest of Israel. And Israel likes to pride itself on the idea that the three monotheistic faiths managed to coexist in Jerusalem, and so on and so forth. Whereas actually, as I said, Christians have very little political representation in the government. There's barely a handful of MPs. They make up a small proportion of the around the 20% non-Jewish minority in Israel. So this is drastic action, but as one of the church leaders said, they're having to play their most their strongest card right at the beginning because they feel they have no other way to make their views to put their views across.
Michael, first of all, on the narrow question of tax, is there any good reason that you can think of why churches shouldn't be taxed like anybody else?
Well, churches are charities, and churches spend a lot of their money supporting such things as hospitals, assistance to the down and out, to refugees, to various others, and they also spend a lot in supporting their own church. That said, some of the churches in Jerusalem are immensely rich because they own a great deal of property. And also, what has been a complicating factor is that some churches, in particular the Greek Orthodox Church, has been extremely corrupt in selling some land privately for the gain of certain bishops and others who have made a fortune and angered their own congregations. And they have been in collusion with Israeli property developers. Now, the other factor that comes into this, as Daniela said, of course, there is local politics. Nearly all the people who attend these churches are Palestinians. They're Palestinian Christians. And Palestinians themselves have some grievance about the way they're treated by the Israelis, especially in Jerusalem. So the church is very sympathetic to the Palestinian grievances. And the church is often a vehicle which voices these grievances to the Israeli government.
But so relations are pretty difficult. It is worth noting, in fact, that both the Jordanian and Palestinian governments have expressed their support for this protest.
Of course, yes, because they feel that this is high-handed and that the churches are being becoming yet another target of Israeli kind of undemocratic fiat in Jerusalem, and they're not represented, not consulted. But I think the Israelis would argue, well, look, you own all this property, you are making a fortune out of it, and surely you can afford to pay for the municipal services that everyone in Jerusalem has to pay for.
Daniela, is it therefore possibly a slight overreaction on the part of the church leaders, to say nothing of a PR line in questionable taste, that, and again I quote, "This reminds us all of laws of a similar nature which were enacted against the Jews during dark periods in Europe"?
Yes, I mean, that is pretty awful, but again, you have to put it in context, where, you know, in the Israeli context, where everyone exploits dark moments in history for political purposes. You know, it's very, very, you hear things in the Israeli Knesset or in Israeli discourse or on television which would be massively offensive here. But for everyone there, the idea of fascism, Nazism and dark periods in European history is just another tool in the political playbook.
Well, yeah, obviously so. But in this specific instance, when they take a line like that, who are they hoping to impress or win over? Because it does seem in this context like kind of a weird thing to say.
Well, their own constituency. I mean, the people and domestically. I mean, the domestic, Michael's absolutely right, the domestic attendees of the church are Palestinian Christians, although most of the money comes from international tourism. So, I mean, think anything that socks it in the eye for the Israeli government is going to play quite well with their people.
Michael, does the persecution complex or suggestion of persecution being made here by the church leaders have any basis in fact? I mean, if for no other reason than the obvious value to Israel of Christian tourism, as Daniela mentioned, why would Israel be seeking to persecute their Christian minority?
I don't think they're seeking to persecute, but they're seeking to put pressure on them in certain ways. One is financial, because they need the money. The other one is they do feel that the church is a kind of law unto itself. The church can lead protests, they can take Palestinian points of view and push them out into the world with more credibility than political leaders of the Palestinians. And therefore, the Israelis have got a bit of a grudge against that, because they feel that sometimes the church is the only kind of real opposition opposition to what they're doing on the West Bank or in the occupied territories. So the relations are not particularly good. And Israel historically has not had good relations with Christianity, which has persecuted Jews for a millennium. Funnily enough, they've had much better relations throughout history with Muslims rather than with Christians, if you look at the European experience. But all that is pretty much a sort of, that's deep background. That isn't really a factor in today's politics. And in today's politics, I think it's just a typical unholy muddle that everyone's got into.
Daniela, where then does the... I mean, I realise there's probably a very, very long answer to this question, but a shorter one, if possible, about where, in terms of Israeli domestic politics, does the Christian church or the various Christian churches fit in? I mean, are they regarded as kind of a... a kind of... I don't know what the phrase I'm looking for is, a sort of proxy front for the Palestinians?
Well, I'm not sure people break it down to that extent. There is very much the way the Israelis see themselves is as the only place in the Middle East where Jews, Christians and Muslims of all sects and of all degrees of observance can rub along together. And they do rub along together with all the problems in terms of religion. I mean, that is a fact. But the picture, again, is much less rosy than they like to paint it. So I don't think there's actually open hostility towards the idea of a Christian presence in the land of Israel. But what that would actually mean in terms of really equal rights for people is something different. It is politicised. The idea of, for instance, a Christmas tree prominently displayed in the Israeli parliament, not a very popular one amongst the Jewish public.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and Michael Binion. Coming up next, Brexit, which we are still doing, apparently.
Soft power is the great game of 2018, and if the last year has taught us anything, it takes only a few missteps to throw a country's delicate image into a spiral. Our annual soft power ranking has had a mighty shake-up. Firm favourites take a tumble, and ambitious newcomers clamour up the list in a year when Emmanuel Macron showed off French élan and Justin Trudeau rolled up his rainbow-coloured socks. Watch our animated ranking that highlights both the successes and the falls of diplomatic heavyweights. Monocle's Soft Power Survey 2017-18, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
You're back. You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Michael Binion. Now, here in the UK, a politician has laid out an actually semi-coherent plan for how Brexit will work in practice. An opposition politician rather than one in government, but it's a start. And anyway, there's still 396 entire days left in which to bring off the most complex administrative task ever undertaken by a modern nation, so it will doubtless all be fine. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, has said that he favours keeping the UK permanently in the EU customs union in order to avoid widespread supply chain chaos and turmoil along the border with Northern Ireland. Michael, first of all, in general, what did you make of Mr. Corbyn's oration?
I was absolutely overjoyed. I thought this at last is putting the Labour Party in a position where it can stop this headlong rush into an absolutely catastrophic crashing out of the European Union, which will really ruin British industry, ruin our economy, do all sorts of bad things, whatever the Brexiteers say. Now, the point is that it's only the customs union he's asking Britain to stay in. Of course, he had plenty else to say, attacking the government on austerity and various other things, but that's what you would expect.
Those are his greatest hits.
He plays well with the party.
He has to do those.
But the what is new is committing the Labour Party firmly to saying that they will vote against anything that takes us out of the customs union. And on that, they probably will gain the support of a small but determined number of Tory supporters, members of Parliament, who are aghast at the idea of crashing out of the European Union customs arrangement. And in that case, given the fact the government has scarcely an overall majority, that particular point of the Brexit negotiations, or at least the plan, would be scuppered.
Daniela, one of the many weirdnesses of this whole circus, of course, is that the pro-Brexit government is being led by somebody who campaigned and voted for Remain, i.e. the Prime Minister Theresa May, and Jeremy Corbyn, who is now agitating for, at the very least, a softer Brexit, is his, you know, entire life a Eurosceptic, if not indeed himself an outright Brexiteer. Do you get the impression his heart's really in this?
Well, gosh, it would have been lovely had he shown such clarity and such campaigning vigour during the actual campaign regarding Brexit, where no one really knew what the Labour Party's policy particularly was on it. And I have my own suspicions, indeed. Like you said, what his particular views are. I mean, this whole speech puts me in a bit of a pickle. I feel just as strongly against Brexit as Michael. But at the same time, I don't buy this. I really don't buy this. And I don't buy...
when you say you don't buy this, what is it you're not buying?
Well, possibly almost everything he says, Mr. Corbyn. And especially this, since it just does not ring true with his long-held views. It's a very clever political move. But although it's not inconceivable to see a government led by him in the not too...
That wouldn't necessarily follow. What he's saying is that the Labour Party will vote when it comes to it, against leaving the customs union. That doesn't commit him to anything else, and it certainly doesn't necessarily mean the downfall of the Conservative Party.
No, absolutely not. But we've come to such a binary point that anything good for him and anything bad for the government, you have to consider that scenario as well. And I have I have no faith at all that he could deliver anything like what he's talking about here, what he's talked about today.
Michael, he does also have another weird political calculation, or difficult political calculation to make, which is that a great many Labour voters, or at least traditional Labour voters and Labour constituencies, voted Brexit. Is he trying to square that circle here?
Yes, he is. I think that number isn't as devastating for him as it might have been a year or two ago, when it would have looked as though he was campaigning against the will of the people. He's accepted the idea that Britain will leave the European Union. He's also spoken about the need to do something about immigration, which for many Labour voters was a key area, particularly in the big cities outside
London. The Brexit vote was a referendum on immigration?
Largely. And that was particularly in poorer parts of Britain and white working class areas where they felt threatened by people coming in. But I think equally, a number of people are beginning to think, well, we weren't told it would cost us money. We weren't told it would cause economic chaos. We weren't told that jobs would be lost and that sort of thing. So he's making it very much a protect jobs issue, which, of course, appeals to people, appeals to core Labour voters. And he's making it very much, we're going to leave the European Union, but we're going to protect our jobs with a customs union. Now, that's just one part of the whole deal. But if he gets that through, then really the sting is out of leaving, and certainly it will infuriate the out-and-out Brexiteers.
Is he, Daniela, do you think, positioning himself in anticipation of the whole thing kind of unravelling over the next 6 or 7 months? I mean, it is, as I said, it's 396 days. That is not a lot of time in which to pull this off.
It's hard for me to answer this, honestly, since I position myself every single morning in the hope that this whole thing will break down. Well, I think he's just playing a short-term political game and making it was a very, very, very clever thing to do today. He's hedging all his bets. He's trying to appeal to this person, to that person, to his constituency, and to the broader other elements in the Tory party. So from that point of view, a win for him. But as I said, I can't really give a proper intellectual answer on this because I want it to be so very much.
Of course, there's also the point that he is very cleverly positioning himself with the Labour moderates, those who are deeply opposed to his leadership, who to a man and woman are nearly all in favour of staying in the European Union. So seeing the leader of the party take a position that they have long supported will in fact make that conflict within the party, perhaps for the moment, slightly less acute.
Just a final thought on this, though, Michael. As a demonstration of how far through the looking glass Brexit has taken British politics, what did you make today of the Confederation of British Industry erupting in warm praise for a speech by Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, you see, they're exactly reflecting what I've just said. They know that all the bits that come to across the channel for car manufacturing, for example, which is, I think, the example he gave, backwards and forwards, it would be chaotic if every single time there was a customs inspection or something like that, and they are determined to try to stop us, Britain, that is, leaving the customs union. We wait to see whether Theresa May will take it on board, because she's making a big speech at the end of the week, which I fear, to use a phrase I saw in the Times today, will be vacuity upon vacuity.
Well, finally tonight, it has become common in recent times to bemoan the declining standards of public discourse and to mourn the civility of a more genteel era and so forth. But is there ever a case for the seeker or holder of public office to speak as many of us do in private? In Texas, Democrat Congressman Beto O'Rourke is raising startling amounts of money towards his planned bid to oust Ted Cruz from his seat in the Senate in November's midterms. And he appears to be doing it with, well, what we can charitably describe as some disarmingly plain talk. He's very much of the Congressman O'Rourke, telling it like it is in language the working man can understand. We did hear him at the top of the show apologising for some of his less judicious language. But, Daniela, really, is there anything wrong with this? Is there a time and a place?
Well, I think there is a time and a place, frankly. And I think that the F-bomb, as he rather coyly put it, is quite amusing, and if used judiciously. It also, cynically, does make people seem more genuine if they F and blind a bit. It does make him seem more man of the people. And you can, in the tapes of him swearing in his public meetings, you can hear the little chortles and the sort of sharp intakes of breath, but in quite a positive way. People seem to like it. So, I generally get more upset by grammar or punctuation than by swearing.
Excellent.
Michael, are there circumstances that merited it? If you are holding or running for public office, and Congressman O'Rourke is doing both, in fact, he is a congressman, he wants to become a senator, should he watch his mouth?
In general, yes, because a lot of people are offended still. Very occasionally, it has an extremely effective expletive force. And if you really, really want to say something, and depending, of course, on your audience, you can suddenly say, "Oh, for God's sake," and out it comes.
Or variations on that.
You can say more after that. But I think it is still in America, particularly in the sort of Bible Belt, still seen as profanity and therefore undesirable. It would also not play very well in Britain either. Although, strange enough, almost every American film now made has people using the F word every other sentence, and many foreigners watching it must think that the F word simply means very.
Well, I mean, I, as mentioned earlier, I come from Australia, where I think we're possibly slightly more forgiving than maybe a lot of places would be. And I mean, I can remember, this is years ago when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister, and it was something of a hot mic incident. But he got accosted at a public meet and greet by an elderly gentleman who had certain issues that he wished to raise. And as Hawke walked away, the microphones picked up him muttering, "Silly old bastard." And I do remember the media trying to confect a great hue and cry until it became apparent that the response of most Australians was, a reasonable assessment of the situation. Daniel, do you have any particular, like, favourite political swearers? Is it a thing?
Well, I mean, what strikes me really is that incident back in the very, very early 90s, when John Major was heard describing his cabinet ministers as those bastards. And although it's quite a mild swear word, it did serve to humanise him. I mean, he said, you know, there was real depth of feeling in what he said, and it was true.
Well, there was an American congressman, was there not, as well, Michael? Was it Morris Udall, am I remembering his name rightly, who, upon being voted out of office, responded, "The people have spoken, the bastards." But the thing is that we know this is how people speak in private.
Yes, that's right. Well, those sort of words, they just fall short of the profanity test, I think, for some people. That's just about okay, and it's heartfelt, and it makes them human. There are certain words, obviously, that you simply don't say, and particularly racist epithets. I mean, that is an absolute taboo kind of thing. It's not really... it is swearing now, but a thing that used to be very common, which was sort of blasphemy swearing. I mean, bloody originally was an abbreviation of By Our Lady, and that was very common, but it's a sort of blasphemous swearing. That doesn't carry much force anymore.
I'm trying to think of a swear word I can get away with at this moment. Over to you, Andrew.
Yeah, unfortunately, that does bring us to the end of today's show. If you just wait for me to read out these credits, you can both swear as much as you like. Daniela Pellard and Michael Binion, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. Music next at 1900, It's Culture with Robert Bound. And do tune into The Daily at 2200 for some highlights from today's Monocle Media Summit 2018. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.